Welcome to the Disrupt Yourself podcast. I'm Whitney Johnson. I'm an author, a speaker, and I write frequently about disruption for LinkedIn and the Harvard Business Review. I wrote a book called Disrupt Yourself that's full of stories about how we can approach personal disruption. On each episode of the podcast, I sit down with a disruptor to talk about what they've learned in order to gain new insights. This episode features a conversation with a disruptor named Sarah Feingold. Sarah is a passionate lawyer and she enjoys playing with fire. She melts, bends, and twists metal into beautiful pieces of jewelry. Fresh out of law school, Sarah the artist was drawn to a growing community of creative people selling their work on a website called Etsy. Sarah the lawyer noticed that the policies for how people bought and sold items on Etsy looked like they could use some legal fine-tuning. The email she decided to write next landed her a full-time job that didn't yet exist.
My name is Sarah Feingold, and I'm general counsel of Vroom.com.
Sarah, thank you so much for being here today. We're actually here in these offices right around the corner from your office at Vroom in the Flatiron District in New York City in a co-working space. So it's fun to be in this area where there's a lot of hustle and bustle and things, people trying to make their dreams come true. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks. Thank you so much for having me.
What's the most disruptive thing you did when you were in school?
When I was in school, well, are we talking about law school? Or are we talking about elementary school?
You too. Whoa.
Well, let's talk about law school because I think that a lot of people go to law school because they are going down a path of not disruption. And while I was in law school, one of the most disruptive things I did was I petitioned my law school advisory board or whatever that was to let me take a graduate level metalsmithing class because I am a jeweler. And it was very important to me to continue my art education at the same time as I was getting my law degree.
Where did you go to law school?
Went to law school in Syracuse University College of Law. Okay. They have a fantastic, I mean, not the law school, but the university has a fantastic arts program. And that was one of the reasons why I chose the law school.
So you knew you wanted metalsmithing when
yes.
you first
yes.
went to law school.
That's in for anybody listening, if you're choosing a law school, go by the arts program. That is pretty much what you should learn from my story.
Right. Oh, yeah. Completely
clearly,
logical.
Clearly.
So what does a metalsmith do exactly?
A metalsmith melts metal with fire, and I pierce metal out with saws. I make jewelry, little small sculptures. I love shiny things. I love small things. And I've been making jewelry since I was 12. I took my first metalsmithing class. And I knew that this was something that I always wanted in my life, but when you make metal things, you tend to have metal things go into your fingers and your back hurts from being hunched over a jeweler's bench. And so I realized physically this was not the path for me, but I always wanted to help metalsmiths and artists in some sort of way, and I thought through law that could really help.
So you didn't decide to go to law school because it was the practical thing to do. It was more of, from a physical standpoint, it was difficult to do metalsmithing all day long, every day.
Correct. Yes. I knew that I physically couldn't do jewelry. It was very, very difficult from a physical standpoint. And I'm a relatively healthy person. it's really hard, emotionally and physically. But I also started...
So physically, why? Because you're bending
over? You're bending over. You're squinting, looking at tiny little things. As you're soldering something, it gets really hot and you'll burn yourself.
What does soldering mean?
That means heating up the metal so hot that the melting point melts the metal, that the metal melts, and so you can combine.
So you can burn your fingers when you do that.
Yeah, seriously, when you're
okay. So you're bending over; it can hurt your fingers. And why is it tough emotionally?
Emotionally, I think that I became really emotionally involved in my pieces, and I couldn't bring myself to sell them and things like that, which apparently you need to do if you want to be a professional artist, put a price tag on it and let them go. But I like to keep everything. But I started thinking while I was making all these beautiful pieces of art, and some of them that were terrible, what aspects of jewelry could be protected by intellectual property and that sort of thing. And so that's what led me to law school, because I wanted to answer those questions for other people.
Interesting. As you think about your professional life, what's the one thing you've done that those closest to you were most surprised by?
Well, professionally, I think what people were really surprised by is how I landed at Etsy and what I did to get there.
Oh.
I was out of law school. I was in Rochester, New York. I was at a firm, an associate at a regular law firm, selling my jewelry on Etsy because I had discovered the website, and I fell in love with it.
So Etsy, what does Etsy do? I mean, I know. Oh. I love it. But sure. I've bought
what
prints
is
on
it?
Etsy, but what does it do exactly?
Etsy is an online venue that connects buyers to sellers. It's mainly for Etsy's mission is to reimagine commerce to build a more fulfilling and lasting world. And you can buy handmade goods and vintage items and commercial crafting supplies directly from really small businesses. And I bought
a lot of prints from there, which I love.
I love it. I buy everything from Etsy, seriously. Mm. I still do.
Okay, so how did you get this job?
How did I get the job?
Yeah.
I found out about Etsy. I was selling my jewelry on Etsy, and I started reading everything about the company. I just thought it was phenomenal. And I realized that they were launching some new policies, and I had some ideas. So I wrote to the customer service team, and I offered some insights from my legal background about how they could update some of their policies. And they responded and said, you know, thank you so much. And I said, you know what, why don't I just speak with your founder, you know? And they gave me his number. So I called.
The founder needs to talk to me.
Clearly.
What year was this?
This was 2007. Etsy had been around maybe around a year or a year and a half. So the founder got on the call with me. We spoke for, I don't know, maybe half hour or so. I gave him some ideas. I hung up the phone and I thought, you know what? This company is amazing. I love this company. Their business model. I'm a seller. I love this company so very much. I think that I can add value to this company, and they clearly need the value that I could add. I booked a JetBlue ticket from Rochester, New York, to New York City, and I called the founder back, and I said, hey, I'm coming down for an interview. You need in-house counsel, and you need it to be
an
me.
Interview with you.
Yeah. Hey, you're interviewing me. I'm showing up. I'm showing up next week. And I flew down. He interviewed me. He hired me on the spot.
He said yes.
Yeah. I broke my lease. I got a Brooklyn sublet. I got malpractice insurance, and I stayed there for over 9 years.
So what did you say to him? Do you remember what advice you gave to him that his interest was piqued?
I think his interest was piqued because I told him I would take on the headache so he could grow the business. I would deal with cease and desist letters. I would negotiate contracts. I would look over confusing attorney's bills, and he could grow the business. I would empower the business growth. I wouldn't be one of those lawyers that would be like, no, 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 no. Mm-hmm. Plus, I knew the community. I know the law. I'm an artist myself. I think that if you're going to hire an in-house attorney, you should hire somebody who really understands the business and can add to it, and somebody who is able to, as I proved to him, add value and empower growth.
And so he hired you on the spot.
Yes.
This is such a perfect example of two things from a disruption perspective. The first is you play where no one else is playing or no one else has thought of playing. And you absolutely thought of, I mean, this is like textbook. You find a job you want, you figure out how you can solve that problem, and then you explain to them how you can solve that problem, and then they hire you.
Yes.
Complete textbook. The second piece of this that's so fascinating about what you've done is you're playing to your, not only to your strengths, but to your distinctive strengths. Because here you were a lawyer, but you said, you know what? I don't want to be a lawyer at a law firm doing litigation around something I don't care about. I want to go be a lawyer inside of Etsy so I can help other artisans, other makers do their work.
Yes.
Amazing.
That's exactly what I did.
Amazing.
Yes.
So what's one of your proudest moments there of something that you accomplished?
I started at Etsy as our 17th employee. When I left a couple months ago, we were well over 800 employees. I was there over 9 years, helped grow the legal team, helped to launch different policies, helped to deal with litigation, deal with employment issues, negotiate contracts. I like to say that, you know, my little fingerprints are all over the website in some sort of way. I really can't point at one particular project that I'm most proud of. A lot of things I literally can't talk about because of attorney-client privilege.
Fair enough.
But really, just helping the company grow in a mission and values aligned way, it makes me so proud to see to read or to even hear people tell me how Etsy has impacted their lives in a positive way.
And you get lots of Etsy stories.
Yes, I'm so lucky.
Is there one in particular?
I remember reading this person sent us an email basically saying, you know, because of Etsy, I was able to buy Christmas presents for my child and I've never had my own money before. And it was just a really beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. And another woman was able to put a down payment on her house because of the money she earned from Etsy. And, you know, every one of those stories, we just would just well up and just smile and all of our hard work. Because it's hard. It's hard to grow a company, especially a company with such passionate community.
Let's talk about your current company.
Okay.
Vroom.
Vroom.
What do you do there? Why did you decide to go there?
So it was a really tough decision to leave Etsy. I'm glowing talking about Etsy. I'm glad you said that because I love Etsy. I don't have anything negative to say about Etsy. It's an amazing, amazing company. But after 9 years, I was getting pretty comfortable.
You were at the top of your learning curve.
I was at the top of my learning curve, and I wanted to be uncomfortable again.
Yes.
And learn new things. And so Etsy had been public for around a year, and I just kind of had my eyes and ears open, and Vroom came along. And I was just really fascinated by their business model disrupting buying and selling cars. And for so many of us, buying a car is not the best experience. And so what Vroom is trying to do is add some transparency and humanity to buying and selling cars, which is a huge purchase. And I just thought that I was really impressed by the team and really impressed by their numbers. And I thought, you know what, this is the time. And so I gave plenty of notice at Etsy. I wanted to make sure that everyone was set up for success. And I joined Vroom. And I've been there for around 4 months now.
So it's a secondary market for cars.
What do you mean secondary market?
So used cars or...
Yes, it's used cars. So what Vroom does is, let's pretend you want to sell a car. Mm-hmm. You fill out some paperwork. We make you an offer. You say, okay, we wire you the money and pick up the car.
It's that simple?
It's that simple.
And if I want to buy a car, so my daughter... She just turned 16.
But yeah,
we're going to need...
You need a car, clearly.
A beater car for her.
Yes. Or so something Vroom, nicer. You want something nice. You want something nice and
enough,
safe.
Safe. We want safe.
Nice and safe. Vroom has some fantastic, beautiful cars on our website. And it's just the fee. That's how much it costs. No haggling. And you can get financing through us and all of that. And you enter your information. We drop it off at your door.
How do you ensure quality control?
We take the cars ourselves.
Oh, because you
we
take ownership.
We take ownership of the cars. You're not buying it through someone, through us, that as opposed
to... Oh, that requires a lot of working capital.
A lot of working capital and a lot of human capital. So we have people who actually physically inspect the cars, make sure that they're up to our standards, correct anything that might be problematic, take photographs of it, put it on our website, deliver them.
So this is like real.
It's real.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's real. Okay. Absolutely. Okay. And I've gone to see all of our cars, and it's kind of surreal because I'm so used to dealing in an environment that's kind of fake. Mm-hmm. I'm like, wow, there are a lot of cars here, and they're all beautiful. Most of them are in Texas, so we have a big facility over in Texas, and that's where the majority of the reconditioning work and all the work gets done.
So you were at the top of your curve at Etsy. You jumped to a new curve, mm-hmm. and you reinvigorated. What are you learning new now?
Oh my gosh, I don't know anything about cars. Now I'm learning so many things.
Okay.
And I'm meeting people, and I'm just learning a ton, mm-hmm. and I'm growing a team and growing another company, and it's fun to do things. Like a lot of people, once you get in a certain position at a company, sometimes you have to delegate a lot, mm-hmm. And you become like a subject matter expert in a very niche area, and now I'm a generalist again, and I'm handling everything. So, you know, an employment issue happens, litigation's going on, we're launching a new product, oh, this contract needs negotiating, I get to do it all
so
again.
So you went from being a specialist to mm-hmm. a generalist again.
Yes.
While you're learning a different industry.
Yes.
Fascinating. What's the hardest thing you've ever done professionally?
Oh, what is the hardest thing I've ever done professionally? Oh, professionally. I mean, listen, I'm doing hard things every day. You know what? I'll tell you the hardest thing I've ever had to do professionally, and it was a couple months ago. I had to terminate several employees, and it's extremely hard. It's extremely, extremely hard. Sometimes when you're a lawyer, you have to do things that just send in a lawyer to do some things that are just really hard to do. And so, you know.
Did you know these people?
I knew them a little bit, but I mean, I had just joined Vroom, so not well. And it's
so you had to play henchman.
Well, not even that.
It felt like it.
Not that you were. Not that I was, but you know, and I had the support of our CEO was there, our CFO was there, but like planning the whole situation is really difficult. And you know,
had you let people go before?
I had, but not as many as at the same time. So that professionally, it's really hard because, you know, I always say I like being in the startup world. There's so much really cool stuff happening. You're dealing with money. You're dealing with IP. But when you're looking someone in the face and realizing that you're giving them some very difficult news, it never gets easier.
No.
It never does. And that's probably the hardest thing I've had to do professionally.
Yeah. It's interesting. When people end up having to leave, how do you treat them with respect so that they know that, I mean, because sometimes you let people go because they're just not performing well. And sometimes you let people go because the numbers aren't what you needed them to be, or they're in the wrong role.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess that differs, but it's hard no matter what.
Even if somebody is, I've had a terminate people who are clearly doing things that they should not be doing, and it's still very difficult.
Hmm.
Yeah.
What's your proudest moment as a developer of talent?
So I don't have any direct reports right now, but I'm hiring. But I had a bunch of direct reports at Etsy, and I would give someone a task, and they would do it so well with minimal oversight, and I would just come in and look at it and just be so, so thrilled that they were just able to take something and run with it, and they did it in their own way. It wasn't exactly how I would have done it, but I didn't care because it was amazing, and it made me so proud to see somebody who, you know, I helped to mentor and get to a place where they don't need me and they could just run with something.
So give me some advice. If I want to have employees like that who are able to flourish, could you give me a couple of tips of some concrete things you did to help them?
Yes, invite them to meetings and let them watch you do what you do and kind of show by example, and bring them in and coach them one-on-one and, you know, give them like smaller tasks and then get them ready for the larger task. And then just basically say to them, listen, you're ready. I trust you. You can do it.
Mm-hmm. Great. And when someone is to the point where, so for example, you were at Etsy, you'd reached the top of a learning curve. When you have someone who works for you that reaches the top of that learning curve, what do you say to them? What do you do? Do you move them?
I think it's important when you are a manager to constantly have career conversations with your direct reports about like where they see themselves and what they want out of the company and what they want out of their career. And, you know, as they start to get really good at certain things, to try to push them in other directions to keep them reaching.
Can you think of an example where you've done that?
Yes, I had a direct report who was fantastic and was really, really good at this one area, and we needed some expertise in another area, and I asked her if she wanted to learn about this, and she was basically like, I don't know anything about it. I'm like, well, you're gonna. Is it something that you're interested in learning about? And she said yes, and so we worked together to try to push her in that direction as well, and she did phenomenal there, and yeah, so it's really as simple as that.
Yeah.
It's as simple and as difficult as that. But, you know, I think it's just a matter of, you know, seeing potential in somebody and really trusting them and encouraging them to flourish.
Best boss ever.
Best boss ever. Okay, so I'm going to go back in time. One of my first bosses who I clerked for when I was in law school. Her name, I'm getting teary because I miss her. She passed away. Her name was Karen DeCrow, and she was the fourth president of NOW, the National Organization for Women, and she's a big feminist. She's in the National Women's Hall of Fame, and I was her clerk. And I was thinking about her today because it's you know, for the election day.
It's election day.
Election day. But I really learned so much from her because she just did things. She was like, I'm going to run for mayor. I'm going to be the first woman to run for mayor. And she did. Hmm. And back in the day, that was just never done. And so when I was talking to her...
In what city was this?
I was in Syracuse. And I was... Back in the day when I was really frustrated in law school, just wondering where is my career going to take me, she pushed me to thinking about writing and speaking engagements and thinking outside the box. And I just learned so much from her and her career and how she was able to just break down barriers for equality. And I never really thought of myself like, oh, I'm a woman. There's no way I could be general counsel of a company because of what she has done. And so she was probably the best boss I've ever had because of the like bigger lessons that I learned from her.
So she modeled for you
mm-hmm.
how you could be.
Yes.
Did she push you hard?
She didn't push me that hard just because I was in law school and I was her clerk, like, you know, part time. But I think after law school, we had this more like friendship and a mentor mentee mm-hmm. relationship, and she would push me, you know, I would tell her things that were going on at Etsy, and she would help push me in certain directions. So
an advisor, a role model advisor.
Yeah, that would be it.
How do you think about risk?
Well, I'm a lawyer, so I think about risk all the time.
Right.
So I think that a lot of lawyers are risk averse, mm-hmm. and that's why you go to law school, because it seems like a path towards a job that makes some money, and people think that money is going to give them some sort of freedom and things like that. But when you are a lawyer for a company, your companies need to take risks. Mm-hmm. And if they don't take risks, then the company's not going to exist anymore. So I'm always pushing outside counsel. I'm always pushing myself to feel like a little uncomfortable and we have to take certain risks, either in our personal life, in our professional life, in our careers. Otherwise, we're never going to get anywhere. And so I'm always trying to take risks and empower our business to take risks. Enough risks, but you always have to understand what are the consequences of the risks and
quantify them. It is interesting to me because I, having been co-founded a number of startups and been an investment manager, I did definitely see that there were lawyers who would say, no, 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 mm-hmm. no, no. Here's why you can't do it. It won't work. And then there were lawyers who would say, all right, I understand what you're trying to get done. Let me figure out how to make it possible for you to get it done. These are the risks, but let's figure out how to get this done.
Yeah.
And I suppose that to be a general counsel, that's what you have to know how to do.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I always say I would have no'd myself out of a job long ago if I just kept saying no. Because your head is, you're in the legal head is saying, there's a risk here, there's a risk here, there's a risk here, there's a risk here. And then you have to just come down from a business standpoint and put on your business hat. And I always think business first, law second. And from a business standpoint, okay, so how big is this risk? And, you know, when you're a smaller company, you can take more risks. And when you're, you know, not regulated, you can take certain risks. And then when you get bigger, you just have to be more thoughtful with the risks that you're taking. And trust your advisors, but at the same time push back at them and say, okay, you're telling me no, why? And you know, what's the worst that can happen, and what are the chances that terrible thing that you think is going to happen is going to happen? And then exactly what you were saying, I try to work with our product managers or engineers or business people to understand what their goals are, why I am uncomfortable, and then tweaking things so that we're all happy.
So if I'm going out to hire a lawyer, how are there any questions I can ask or think through to ferret out a lawyer who thinks business first, law second versus law first, business second?
Well, you know, there are a lot of lawyers out there mm-hmm. and they all specialize in different things and have different ways of going about. If you give a contract to 10 lawyers, you're going to get 10 different red lines of the agreement. Different people have different issues with different languages. I could just ask, you could just ask that question, you mm-hmm. know, what do you think about taking risks, or what do you think about, what do you see your role as being my advisor? Because there are definitely times when lawyers just see themselves as being the most conservative taking the most conservative approach, and that's okay, but you have to know that what you know what's best for your business, so to ask those follow-up questions. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's time to hire, you know, an inside counsel like me to be the go-between. And that's right. One of the ways that I pitched myself to Etsy back in the day, because, you know, lawyers, they have these giant bills and they're writing these giant memos and they're saying no, and I'm in between, basically saying, okay, you know what, you're the expert in this area of law, but I'm the expert in this company. Let's take this information and tweak it so that I can feel happy. And so will my
How did you team. Learn how to negotiate? Because that's what you do all day long.
I
every
do that
day.
All day long.
You learn how to you know how to negotiate.
Right.
Is this something you did when you were growing up, or
probably.
Is this something?
My parents are entrepreneurs. So I, you know, saw them grow businesses. And I've always been interested in business. So maybe that's where it came from.
You saw them negotiate.
Yeah. Probably. I probably saw them negotiate. Or, and I like negotiating. And I, you know, maybe that's why I went to law school, like argue and negotiate.
You enjoy the process.
I enjoy the process.
How old were you when you figured out you knew how to, that you enjoyed it?
I don't know. Maybe right now. Right now, I just figured it out.
Because I think negotiation, it's something that some people do very well and some people do really poorly. They don't know how to. They only know how to say yes, and they sometimes mean no when they say yes. Right. Some people only know how to say no. And it's a very, there's a real art to being able to say yes and no, or no but, or no and, or yes and. It's a skill.
You're right. But I think the heart of negotiating is trying to understand why somebody wants what they want and why you want what you want. And sometimes you can get to everyone's happy. Or everyone feels like, you know, they're getting what they need.
Or everybody's
happy.
Everybody's a little bit happy and everybody's a little bit sad.
it's give and take.
That's the best deal.
It's give and take, you know, because it's not always like I want the most money. It could be like I need this done today because I have to go pick up my kids, you know, or something like that, you know. And so really understanding, you know, what drives a person, what drives a company, and where they're willing to give and take.
Right. Yeah. And one question I've been thinking about a lot recently is this question of when a person wants to disrupt themselves inside of an organization, they may not want and do something lateral, for example, take on a whole new, you know, go from operations to marketing. And it seems to me that that's a time where negotiation is really required, because you don't want to give up your title. You don't want to give up your pay, or at least hold it flat. And it would seem that's a time where negotiation and the ability to negotiate holds you in very good stead.
Yeah, absolutely. And thinking about why. Why do you want to do this change? And what can you sacrifice to get this? Is it, you know, you're just passionate about marketing and you always wanted to go into it, so maybe you should take a little bit of a pay cut because you don't know as much as somebody else who's coming in, but you know the business and you know all the key players and you can show value added really quickly. But, you know, you're just making sure you set expectations for yourself and understanding why. Why is this the path that you
take? So that's the most important word, isn't it? Why?
Probably, yes.
Why?
Why?
What do you wish someone would dare you to do?
Dare me to do? I don't know. I have no idea.
Because sometimes there are things that we want to do, but we need a little bit of an accountability partner.
Oh, okay.
To say...
Like a gym partner? Like, hey, we're going to the gym today.
Yeah.
Are you going to the gym? We're going to the gym today. I'm usually that person.
I'm
usually the pusher. Like, if somebody says to me, like, I'm miserable in my job, I'm like, why? Why are you miserable? What do you need? Have you been applying for other jobs? Is your resume up to date? Like, what are you doing about it? Stop complaining. What are you doing? Do something small every
day. So you're daring yourself, is what
you're
saying.
I guess so. Yeah, I'm always daring myself. And I'm always trying to push myself in different directions. And I ask myself, like, why? Why am I? Because I, you know, I'm a jeweler. I'm a lawyer. I'm a speaker. I'm a writer. Like, why am I? I'm a mom. Why am I going in all these different directions? I'm curious about so many things.
What are you writing about right now?
What am I writing about? I'm writing about my career path. A lot of people have been really inspired by my career path to Etsy and then to Vroom, and I've been speaking a lot about my career path. And so a lot of people have said to me, you know, maybe you should turn this into a book. I'm like, okay. So basically taking my talking points from my speaking engagements and so many people calling me for advice and turning it into something more tangible, more accessible to other people.
So what advice would you give people? What's something you say to people when they reach out to you for advice?
I tell them to create their own opportunities. Mm-hmm. I tell them to not wait for things to come to them. I think we're all so waiting for the... People say, oh, but there was no job description at Etsy. How did you know they were hiring a lawyer? They weren't. There was no job description. There was no mentor. I didn't have a computer my first day. I brought my own laptop. Like, I didn't have a desk. I had to go buy it on Craigslist. Like, there was nothing. But I did it, you know, and I just had faith in myself. And so I say, create your own opportunities. And if you don't know something, there's so much out there that you can learn it. Like I say, use all the brains you have and all the brains you can borrow. Like, ask people. I feel so fortunate. I think the story of how I got my job at Etsy is great, but I kept my job for a long time until it was time for me to move on by using brains and borrowing brains and paying for brains outside counsel. I mean, I'm not gonna pretend I did everything on my own. But just my biggest piece of advice is just create your own opportunities.
Yeah. Use, borrow, and buy brains.
Yes,
I like that.
Use, borrow, and pay. You need to pay.
Oh, right, and pay
totally
for brains.
Totally fine.
How are you going to disrupt yourself in 2017?
In 2017, I hope to have a book deal by then. I hope to have a book deal in 2017. I'm heading down that path.
Have you written your book proposal already?
I have. It's finished. I'm finishing it up.
Talking to an agent.
I don't have an agent yet, but I'm getting there.
Sounds like it. Yeah. Sounds like you're close.
I'm close. I have the book proposal. I have a lot of things. I have to prioritize my time, right? Mm-hmm. And my number one priority is this little tiny person that runs around.
How old's your baby?
He is 3, and he is delicious. I love his little face. And so I just, you know, I don't want to be working on a book proposal on the nights and weekends when I can be playing trains with him. And so I need to prioritize everything, and he's my number one priority. And I, you know, have a full-time job
and do
those little things, but... You know, I'm not in a rush to get, you know, public. And people have said to me, are you an author or are you a lawyer? I'm a lawyer. If I become an author, that'd be great. But I'm a lawyer. That's my day job. But I'm a mom. Mm-hmm. That's really important.
You're a lawyer and mom, and you write and talk about your experience.
And I talk about my experiences. I speak every once in a while, and I write. But I need to prioritize my time, and that mm-hmm. and he's my number one priority.
Yeah.
And work is
right.
A priority too.
So in 2017, you're going to disrupt yourself
yes.
by getting a book
yeah.
deal.
Yeah, let's try that.
That. Yeah. I like that. So that's
pretty
your
good.
Dare too. Although you don't need to be dared because you're going to do it anyway.
I know. Well, the proposal's pretty much done. I just have to finish it up. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'll disrupt myself by finally getting my child out of diapers because he is very stubborn, like his
Ooh,
mom.
Ooh, that's good. I like that.
Yeah.
Well, Sarah, thank you very, very much for spending a few minutes with me. I really appreciate it. It's super interesting, and I am absolutely 100% confident that you will get that book deal.
Thank you.
So I can't wait to hear about it.
Thank you.
Wow. I hope that learning about Sarah's experiences is helpful to you as it was to me. Here are some of my key takeaways. The first is that Sarah took her two passions and created a job at a company she didn't yet work for. Her proactive approach to getting a job with Etsy is a great example of playing where no one else is playing. She created her own opportunity. The second is that after 9 years at Etsy, Sarah had reached the top of her learning curve. She knew it. So she went to look for a new challenge. The third takeaway is that Sarah gives a great tribute to her personal mentor, who challenged her to think in unconventional ways, and that the largest boundaries by far are the ones we impose on ourselves. What were your takeaways? I'd love to hear via Twitter at Johnson Whitney or via email at whitney@whitneyjohnson.com. Thank you also to my producer, David Klatt, editor Heather Hunt, and art director Brandon Jameson. I'm Whitney Johnson, and this is Disrupt Yourself.